is now.
Capital 263.
Welcome to Politics and Beyond on Capital 263. My name is Christopher Farai Charamba.
My name is Upenyu Makoni Matenga.
And I'm Tawanda Henry Beatty. And yeah, welcome to the best political podcast in the country, on the continent, certainly in this hemisphere. Once again, we have a very valued guest. I found other words besides special today.
That dictionary app is working for you, huh?
Thesaurus.
Yes, indeed, we do. Tondorai Mudambo.
Hi. Welcome. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
No, thank you for being here. Today is, what's the day today? The 12th of August.
Yep.
Ah, indeed, oh. Yes. Yeah. So we're recording yet another episode.
Yeah.
Henry is still ameno kwa ari gogo.
Out there in the diaspora.
Living in the diaspora. But yeah, no, thank you, Tonde. Tonde actually blogged about us. Mm-hmm. We made a list. You know how Zimbabweans love making lists? Like, in the sense of being on a list is a big thing.
Really? Yeah. Okay, I appreciate that. Yeah, I didn't expect like a lot of or as many people who responded to it to respond to it, because it was just like a list of the podcasts I like listening to, and Politics and Beyond is my favorite Zimbabwean podcast. So.
Shout out to us.
Yeah.
It's because it's the good. Best Zimbabwean podcast.
That is true. That is true. So tell our listeners, tell us what
okay,
you do.
Okay, I'm Tondorai. I'm a law grad. I specialize in financial law, corporate finance, mergers and acquisitions. And yeah, I'm currently looking for a job though. So in my spare time, I write, I blog, I do activism, civic society stuff. Yeah, basically.
Impressive.
Okay, thank you.
It's
a space. I think we're going to be accused very soon of harboring activists.
Oh. Is that a bad thing?
No, it's not a bad thing. Yeah. It's not a bad thing, actually.
She must just say that she's got political ambitions now.
Yes, come out in the open.
No,
that's what it is. Activists tend to then want to jump into the political, sphere.
Yeah.
It's okay, Tunde, be the change.
No, I will let others, Bakuru achunga it.
That was some shade, though, Henry.
That was a lot of shade.
It wasn't shade.
Upenyu, when are you launching your political career?
Any moment now. Just keep an eye out. You'll see it. It'll be the pink party, you know. I think our symbol will be maybe, I don't know, pink panties. I don't know. We're working it out. We're working it out.
Yeah. The pink panties.
Watch the space.
This year, Makala Chapira.
I was actually thinking, Henry, if we were to start our own, what colors would we pick, Sha?
Black?
I don't know. May I like teal? I like teal.
Who said teal? Black?
Teal.
I just
teal.
Teal.
Yeah, black.
Why black?
I don't know. To represent the people, I guess.
Oh, okay. You're like black is for the people. Green is for the... Yeah.
Yeah.
And teal. That's very revolutionary.
Anyway, yeah, today we're going to be... discussing a couple of things. There's things happening beyond our borders, so we get to do a bit of a beyond episode today. Elections in Kenya. There was also the vote of no confidence this week in South Africa. Jacob Zuma, they're trying to impeach him and failing.
It's because he can dance, you guys. I saw a video and I was like, that's why that guy isn't going anyway. He can dance. He's got moves.
That's all you need.
That is all I need. He's got my vote for
Robert.
That guy, I haven't seen him dance.
But he's been there, Kafo.
Maybe he's doing it for other people.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Anyway, yeah, and then we'll come to what's happening locally. We've got a $1 billion university that's about to hit Mazowe.
Mugabe you.
Yes, Mugabe you. And then... there was the video of Professor Moyo's presentation to Politburo also came out this week.
Leakers.
So yeah, so we'll discuss a bit about that. And I don't know what else is happening. I know there's another youth the interface, something, something happened.
Today,
yeah. And my Mugabe is not there.
Okay.
I think she's gone to, for a checkup.
No headlines then.
What is ZPC going to do for content? That sucks.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, Kenya elections. They took place on Tuesday, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a lot of controversies that happen in African elections. Whoa. Let's start there. And a lot of parallels can be drawn to what's happening, you know, what's happened there and what could potentially happen here. Their election commission was accused of being fraudulent. Raila Odinga lost, but he says that the elections were rigged. He came out with some evidence of, I don't know, something to
of tampering with the electrics,
with the final counts. Yeah,
tampering, and then
didn't he like just declare himself to be the president of Kenya?
Yeah, he said. Odinga.
Yeah, he did.
Oh yeah, he did.
So there's that whole thing, and Kenyatta is really, I think this time around, even as much as people might want to say, you know, all sorts of things about rigging, and Odinga has put up this fight, I think Kenyatta has really just sailed through, because the observers seem to think, you know,
didn't think that it was a bad election. From what I understood, people more in Kenya were more concerned about political violence as compared to the 2007 election. So, that guy survived.
Who? Kenyatta?
Kenyatta, yeah. Uhuru.
Kenyatta? No, I think Kenyatta is being rightly rewarded for good economic management in the last few years, because if you look at where Kenya was in 2007 and where Kenya is in 2017, just economically, they've taken leaps and bounds. I mean, it's not perfect, but they've definitely, you know, demonstrated growth. And I think Kenya was one of the first, you know, African economies to move away from agriculture being, agriculture and mining being their primary, you know, economic drivers. Like, so I think Kenyatta is just being rewarded for sound economic management.
But is economic management, it feels a little bit like it's a trade-off. Do you want, you know, full civic rights, or do you want economic prosperity? That's kind of what it feels like.
I don't know. The whole situation is a bit weird to me, because I think his father was the president, and then Raila Odinga's father was also the vice president. So there's a lot of maybe legacy that's in Uhuru Kenyatta's favor, I think. Yeah. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think Kenyatta's reasonably done well for Kenya over the last 10 years. There is definitely legacy, and he's also got a lot of money
in his
own capacity.
That helps.
So it definitely helps in terms of the election. It helps that he was an incumbent, mm-hmm. and he had the reach, he had the resources of the state. Odinga, on the other hand, has been in the opposition for a very long time. You know, and his father was actually in the opposition as well, I think. So it's really a dynasty thing, and mm-hmm. I saw a lot of people online were commenting and saying that they are so pleased that this will be the last time they will see Kenyatta and Odinga on the ballot box. Like this is it.
I wouldn't be surprised. I'm sure they've got sons as well.
Yeah. Can Odinga run again for the third time after this?
Yeah, or? He can run as many times.
But isn't he 75 now?
Oh, okay. So?
Yeah, no, he's an old man.
Since when does that matter in Africa?
Right, because didn't like the president, the former president of Senegal, he's 91 and he just ran again in their elections like last month. So Odinga, you know, you can...
I mean, look, the thing is...
How old is our president? He's got time. He's got another 20 years.
Yeah, but the thing is you, how much of a toll does it take to continue losing? It would be different. The former president of Senegal, he is 91, but, you know, he won an election at some point, or he became president at some point, you know. But Odinga is a serial loser.
But he's also a career opposition politician.
Yes.
So, and... Clearly, as you say, there's legacy there. So what else? I mean, is he? What is he going to do?
No, he's also got money. He's also got.
But that's his job. That's literally his job.
Man, I don't know. At 75, you're
his job is to run for president.
He may not get tired. It's just like I think his name is Besigye in Uganda. Yeah. He's been the Yoweri Museveni's been like the president of Uganda almost as long as our president has been in power, and that guy's been around for I think more than a decade, and he keeps losing, like not even close, but he's still going. So
yeah,
maybe he feels like he has some sort of purpose.
So at this juncture, let me draw some parallels to what's happening in our own country, because this seems to be the template in African countries. You've mentioned Uganda, Kenya, Zimbabwe. We've had a long-term president, and we've had a guy in the opposition who's been there, what, 18 years now?
Since 1998.
This is going to be his 2005, 2013. This is going to be his fourth election. And despite what happened in 2008, he didn't, you know, come out as president, but he's going to go into this next election, and he's likely to lose again.
But it's a career.
But
it's a job.
I think. I don't know. I think people are a bit unfair to opposition leaders. Like, you know, what you see in, for example, the Kenyan stance, Odinga in 2007. There was so much violence that he was forced into a power-sharing deal, not with Uhuru Kenyatta, but with Mwai Kibaki. And that's when he came in to be prime minister of Kenya at that time, and they led them to the next election, and then he lost that election to Kenyatta, who was backed by Kibaki then. So I think the differences are significantly there. Previous to that, he had actually been in the government. He wasn't in the opposition. He had actually been in the government. He was a minister. So, you know, just that's on the specific Kenyans thing. But I think that in general, your political environments breed, they mirror each other, because it's dangerous to step up and be opposition in a place like Uganda or in Zimbabwe or in Kenya. So you find people who have made it and who have staying power, the ones that are constantly turned to and looked towards to lead the opposition.
No, it's for me, it's very interesting in the sense that we speak that when we're looking at a Pan-African idea and the things, the similarities between different countries and what the solutions could possibly be. I know that Tsvangirai was he in Uganda or was he in Kenya?
I think he was in Kenya.
He was in Kenya, before the election. And these guys are, you know, trying to figure out how they can take on the incumbents.
I think it's difficult, even when we get, I think later on when we speak about South Africa, for you to, like I said, Kenyatta has the legacy of his father being like, you know, the former president. Was his father the first president? Yeah, so he has that whole, the revolutionary legacy and things like that. And for some people, maybe if they don't like the head of the party, they'll still vote for the party because they feel like that's the party that brought independence, and they have all of that sort of mythology around them. So, and I guess most of our African countries are still developing rural-based. So for people in the rural areas, that's what they know. And I think it's hard for opposition parties like the MDC, who start off in the unions, which are mostly in the cities, to branch out to where most people are living in the rural areas. Maybe that's what it is.
I definitely agree with you that it's difficult for an urban movement to translate its grievances to a rural population, because their lived reality is vastly different from an urban population. But on the issue of running and career politics particularly, my problem is that there's no... we don't necessarily have a thinking or an understanding that if somebody has failed a certain number, 3-4 elections, and you have yet to beat the incumbent, then perhaps it's time for different thinking, different blood, a different set of people to take on that problem. And I agree with you, Henry, that yes, you know, it's hard being an opposition politician, but maybe the issue is also that we want to hold on to the little bit of power that we do have, and we're not looking at what the big picture is, which is to remove the incumbent and create a better democratic society.
No,
I can agree. Speaking of removing incumbents,
before we get to that though, interestingly enough, also in Kenya, you had the Boniface Mwangi situation. Who Boniface Mwangi started off as an activist, And then he launched his political career. He ran for to be a member of parliament, and he had a huge social media presence, online presence. I think his Twitter has 700 and something thousand followers. You know, he gained international attention. People were very interested in what it was. And he ran a brand new campaign, very different from how, you know, everyone had done it. And everyone thought, online at least, he was going to win. And he lost to the Jubilee Party candidate. I think his name, he was an artist, music artist. His name's Jaguar. And he came third, actually. I think he got 13% of the vote. The guy who came first got like 50-something, and the other guy got like 30-something or something. So it was quite a shock to people.
Was it an urban constituency?
Yeah, it was largely urban. And it was urban. It was a constituency I think he actually came from. So
does he live in Nairobi or
I'm not sure what the name of the constituency is, but he's from that constituency. He's based in Kenya.
But
yeah, I mean
700 and something thousand, what is it, Twitter followers?
Yeah.
They're not all in Kenya, guys.
No, that's true.
Twitter is global. Yeah, and that doesn't translate to votes.
Kenya, like, you know, it's like a tech hub.
Yeah.
So a lot of people in Kenya have the internet and they use it a lot. And Kenya's, what is their population? It's quite big. So it's not a stretch to imagine that, like, maybe people are following him and they're listening to what he's saying and they're responding to it, but they may not, one, live in his constituency, and then two, they may not actually agree or want to vote for him just because they're following him on Twitter.
48 million is the population.
48 million. Yeah. So,
but I think it's what's his name? Malcolm Gladwell coined this term, clicktivism. So your 700, it's so easy to click on somebody's follow, the follow button, right? Mm. But are you, when you click, are you going to leave your house and go and vote? Are you going to register to vote? Isn't this the same problem that we're facing in Zimbabwe? Because it really worries me when candidates say, no, I saw on social media that people were calling me to run for the presidency. And I think I have a chance, but you haven't measured that. What does that mean? Because your 200,000 Twitter followers might be 10,000 in Zimbabwe, 200 who are going to vote, and then the remainder are out in the diaspora. So I think we need to be a little bit more realistic about popularity online versus popularity with the grassroots.
Henry?
Yeah, I agree. I don't really see, and I worry about that. I'm drawing some parallels with his campaign with some of our own,
activist cum politicians.
Activist cum politicians, online activists. I think that running a campaign, and it's the same conversation we're having with Dr. Nkosana, is that people do things a certain way for a certain reason. And, you know, whether you're running for president of the United States, whether you're running for prime minister, there's certain things that politicians do, including rallies, including, you know, these meetings and things like that, because they work. So, I would never look at my Twitter following count and think that's a measure of my influence on the ground.
I mean, let me not put down what Boniface did, because he was on the ground and he did run an on-ground campaign. But I think, you know, there is that balance that is there. And in contrast, then you have John Paul Muirigi, who was 24 years old, a student. He won in his constituency. He had no money for posters. He literally went door to door, and he eventually got help from the Boda Boda drivers, or I think they're the taxi drivers in Kenya. And he won in his constituency. So you look at, I'm not sure what kind of constituency it was. I think it might not be as urban as, you know,
But he hooked up with the power block. Taxi drivers.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a power block.
Makombi driver.
Yeah.
It's a serious, you're on the ground. I mean, remember when that Nkosana Zim dancehall song came out, and I commented and I said, if he can get this played in Makombi, then he's literally got wide distribution. So it's very interesting to see, the way different things work. Mm. And I don't think there's a formula to it. You can't downplay online campaign or online presence. But at the same time, elections are fickle.
Yes.
But they're also a trust factor. People have to sort of believe in the individual and so and trust that if I put my vote next to your name, then I'm going to get something serious out of it.
I don't know if it's about belief in the candidate. I mean, imposition of candidates is a testimony to that. You don't necessarily have to believe in the candidate.
True. So maybe belief also in, or trust in, if it's not the candidate, then the party.
Maybe not even, but for me it's about kingmakers and power brokers. So the 24-year-old in Kenya.
That's a type. That sounds like a title of a good book.
I'm working on it. Don't worry. But if you hook up with ZANU-PF is a power broker and a kingmaker, right?
Mm.
Yeah. So if you hook up with either one of those in your ecosystem, you're bound to win something. But I don't believe that a candidate anywhere can make it on their own. I honestly don't. Our dynamics are too complex for that.
Yeah, very interesting. So
I hope you're wrong, but I don't have any evidence to the contrary.
Well, the thing is, you have to get support, guys, and you have to get some sort of endorsement or people to vouch for you in some formal way.
Yes,
because you can't speak to everyone. So even when I speak to, you know, someone I know on your behalf, then there has to be that trust factor. There has to be, you know, people vouching for you at the end of the day.
Exactly.
Yeah, fair enough. Jay-Z?
South Africa.
Jacob.
He stays winning, doesn't he?
Yeah,
that's a power broker. That is a power broker. His ex-wife went to his. She's helping him with. He's helping her. Sorry.
With her Kosana Dlamini
Zuma. Yes.
Mm-hmm. She's going to be the next president if he survives. So she might really well be the next South African president.
I think she will be. Well, too. If she manages to be president of the ANC, I think her main rival is Cyril Ramaphosa. But if she manages to be president of the ANC, then it's sort of a done deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. So Mshololozi was up against the opposition parties for the eighth time. This was their eighth attempt to impeach him, which is quite wild, to be quite honest. But says a lot about their democracy. I mean, I don't think we'd even get a impeachment
one.
But yeah, so the interesting thing about this one was it was by secret ballot.
For the first time.
Yes, Baleka Mbete, the Speaker of the House, shocked everyone on Monday when she came out and she said, "I'm just saying my statement, no questions." Mm-hmm. At the press conference, no questions. I'm just going to tell you what it is. Secret ballot. And then she walked out.
Wasn't she following a constitutional ruling?
She was. Yeah. So, but the constitutional ruling said that she has the power to decide, but her decision must be a fair one. It must take in all the considerations, because there is no in their constitution. It doesn't say whether it should be by secret ballot or secret or open. Or, it just says that the speaker has the power to decide what it is. But the problem was everyone in the opposition said it had to be secret ballot because some people fear to intimidation.
Protect. ANC members want to vote against the president.
Exactly. So she decided, and then they went and they voted on Tuesday again, same day as Kenyan elections. Mm-hmm. And I think there were 177 votes to impeach, 198 not to impeach, and about, I think it's 20-something.
Spoiled.
Abstained.
Abstained.
Abstained. No, or nine.
And you needed two.
Nine abstentions.
Yeah. And they needed 201 to impeach him.
Yeah.
And what it is, though, is that there were actually about 30 or so members of the ANC who either abstained or they voted to impeach Zuma. Mm. So the margin is actually getting smaller, because the last time I think you had 100.
It was a whitewash.
Yeah, you know. So the margin's getting smaller, and it goes to show the how unsettled the ANC actually is right now.
It's Zuma's fault, because he hasn't truly allowed Cyril or truly allowed the successor to emerge before the coming Congress. He's the one that's causing the nonsense and the noise in the party at the moment, because generally what we've seen is that going into the Congress where they're changing presidents, is the leader is anointed already.
But don't you think, I mean, in view of Kosana Dlamini Zuma's aspirations, don't you think that there's a little bit of back office play, or something is happening in the back office for him to hold the door open?
No, she's his preferred candidate. My understanding is it's Gupta money versus white capital money in Cyril Ramaphosa's white capital finance and Gupta money in Kosana Dlamini Zuma, who in her own right is a very capable and very very accomplished woman, but unfortunately she's irrevocably tainted by Jacob.
Yeah, I think there's that, but I think I'm fairly certain that, like, there's the Gupta issue as far as Zuma is concerned, but I'm certain there's also white monopoly capital that's sponsoring Zuma in some sort of way. But I guess because Cyril's, like, you know, the big businessman and things like that, then it sort of seems like it. But I don't think the two are, like, completely divorced as how people are trying to paint it. I think, I don't know, it's a difficult one. I think maybe it's because also she's a woman and there's never been a woman president of the ANC, that maybe there might be some dissension in terms of that. That's
a factor,
not the main one, but I think it's a factor.
Yeah, I was reading an article about her in the, I think it was the Department of Home Affairs, and it was actually, it was attacking her ability to lead, her ability to make decisions. And it was just, and her leadership style in general was, you know, sort of describing her as very cold and distant and, you know, very much about the letter of the law. And I don't think that's a quality that's necessarily desirable in a politician. I mean, you contrast her with Jacob Zuma, for instance. So I think, yes, I agree with you that partially it is because she's a woman and we're a little bit afraid of women with power. God knows why.
Yeah, maybe also the anti-intellectualism thing, yes. Which is very funny because she used to be married to Jacob Zuma, but she's a doctor. So
he
in a way,
dance.
They're sort of like a foil to each other. So, yeah, I don't know. Yeah,
it's interesting, the factionalism in the ANC and what it's done to their power base. Because whilst it's happening, people are looking for other options. The AFF has become an option. The DA has become an option. Before, it used to be, you know, very white, but now it's started to change, and people have, you know, picked a lot more interest in it. And Ramaphosa, one of the things he doesn't have going for him is that he comes from a minority tribe in South Africa.
What is his tribe?
I think he's from the Sotho.
Okay.
I think so. Either, I'm not too sure, I'll have to check. But he's not one of the major ones, which is the Xhosa and the Zulu. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there is that factor as well playing within the ANC dynamics. And it will be interesting. I really do think that the ANC is going to, whatever happens at their Congress, whoever the next leader is, straight after that, they're going to boot Zuma the same way they booted Thabo Mbeki. If it is Ramaphosa, it might not be the same if it is Nkosasana Dlamini Zuma, but really I don't think it would be wise for them to take him all the way to 2019.
Because no, definitely not.
They'd get a drubbing in that. I mean, they'd still probably win the election, but it would be very close.
They'll definitely lose parliament. They'll lose parliament.
Yes. They'd likely lose parliament.
You think he'd be a one-term president?
Who?
Ramaphosa.
Ramaphosa, yeah, he'd probably go on one term.
He probably would. What's you know, like, I keep watching this South African situation with such fascination and a lot of jealousy, because I keep thinking to myself, no matter how bad Zuma is, no matter what happens, they know that he's going in 2019. Like, they have that in their heart, they know. But they're making all this effort to get him going now, like, but for them, they know, look, at the end of the day, in 2019, he's gone no matter what. And for me, that's something I really envy.
I think they're like, no, we're not going to let you get away with the full 2 terms. Go now. Go.
Yeah.
they set a precedent with Mbeki, which is, you know, a wrong precedent. Because
you said a wrong president.
A wrong precedent. And because it was Zuma who was involved with that, he's really doing everything he can not to go. So he's, the way the ANC is structured now is really for
him. Was it not Zuma and Malema who did that to Mbeki?
It was. And then Malema saw the light.
Did eventually, yeah. Because even like the EFF, it's actually like a breakaway of the ANC Youth League.
Yeah.
Basically.
It actually is. Yeah.
So, but you know what? Kudos to South Africa, because one thing I hope we do achieve in 2018 is we get a balanced parliament. So whoever comes out with a majority must just not have an absolute majority of 2/3, because it really makes things. You go through 5 years and whoever has the absolute majority can literally do what they want. There's only two parts of the constitution that have to go to referendum. That's the Bill of Rights and the land issue. Mm. Everything else, it just needs a 2/3 majority to pass in parliament. And we saw what happened with the First Amendment, recently. So I really do hope that we have a strong parliament in the sense that there is some sort of balance next year.
But do you think that can happen, considering our main opposition party has not been participating in local government elections? Do you think it's possible?
I do think so. I think by-elections are a lot different to national elections, but the danger is that I think opposition parties might be too focused on the presidential election that they're not putting effort into who's running in the parliamentary elections.
No, go ahead, finish.
So if they are not people on the ground, if they are not actively working and campaigning in their own right, in their own constituencies, then we could end up with a situation where, you know, they, at the last minute, they rush to find out, especially with this coalition situation going on, they rush to plonk people in different constituencies to fill the 210 seats, and then they just get a complete drubbing, because ZANU-PF is on the ground right now.
Oh, yeah. I agree.
Yeah, no, I think...
Go ahead.
I definitely agree with those sentiments. I even tweeted that as much. Is that if I was in the opposition right now, running a campaign, I would be starting from the bottom up. I wouldn't be even worried about the presidential candidate. Because I think my estimation is that it's a foregone conclusion who is going to be the next president. But what you need to do is stop ZANU from... The first thing they'll do if they win a supermajority again, in their first sitting in parliament, they're going to amend the constitution and remove term limits on the president. Mm. The next thing that
They're just going to change those schedules, aren't they? Their schedules to after that, some certain things that come into effect after 10 years. So after the two terms, we really don't need a 2/3 majority.
But you know, I think the problem is in terms of thinking and is in terms of strategy. So because every opposition movement that has announced its aspirations has started with "I'm running for president." And that has always percolated down to issues within, I mean, fractures. How many MDCs do we have now? To fractures, and even with, the Zimbabwe People First, also fractured because of the issue of presidency. I agree with you that in terms of strategy, it's a very bad strategy to try to take out a guy who has the behemoth of the entire country running, you know, a campaign strategy for him. And I think... You're very right to say that, you know, start small, start in the council, start in parliament, get your majority there, because that's actually how you guarantee a constitution.
Yeah, I think isn't that what the EFF, to bring it back to the South Africa example, to compare, they did that, and then in their municipal elections in 2016, that's how they managed to gain, like, I think was it 1 million votes the first time that they'd ever, and they're starting small. They're not saying yes, we want to want to take out, you know, Zuma's ANC, want to remove their majority, but you can tell that the EFF is on the ground.
Yes.
They're in the universities, they've got, you know, EFF Youth League, they're there, and, you know, they're visible, not just as far as Julius Malema. Because for us, for example, in Zim, who knows who the president of the MDC youth is?
There you go.
But we know Mbuyise Nidlozi. We know Simamkele Shakavu. The other people in the EFF, other than Julius Malema that are visible, who are there, who are young, and who are on the ground, they're doing things. But in Zim, can we say the same?
No.
So, but we're not.
It's a combination also of the media spaces that are available to South Africans. The fact that Malema can be covered by, you know, AN7, by ETV without even being covered by SABC. So, like, I think a lot of that has to do with the access to information that we have in the country.
But you know what? I agree, but on the flip side, we do, in the print press at least, we have a lot of independent newspapers who also don't write about a wide spectrum of things. You know, the narrative is very polarized, but it's also very thin. Mm-hmm. They don't cover widely. And I also don't know if political parties themselves take the initiatives to use platforms to get their message out to, you know, as holistically. So you'll hear about what the upper echelons of the political parties are doing, but when it comes to the structures and going down, what's happening at those levels? I mean, it's very, you know.
Yeah, we ourselves.
I mean, I wouldn't call 7 or 8 independent newspapers a lot.
It's enough.
No. I'm not saying it's, in terms of newspapers, it is. But I'm not saying it's the be all and end all of the media space. But it is an avenue that I don't think is being utilized well enough.
I agree. Because I think media in its entirety, even independent media, does create that monolithicness of ZANU-PF, because it's sort of, there's no way for you to attack the structure, right? There's no other way for you to attack the structure other than to say, okay, I want to run for presidency. But we know that the structure can be very weak at the bottom. But because we're all focused on this one giant shiny thing, It's difficult. It's difficult to take apart.
And there's just, like, I agree. I don't think we have a very healthy political or vibrant political culture in this country. It's just very much focused on the center of power.
Yeah.
And the cult of personality.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe people don't even know, like, who my MP is.
Exactly. I don't think people are even invested in that.
I mean,
yeah.
Which ward am I in?
People don't care. That's why we vote by party.
I'd say there is a demographic in the urban areas, but if you move out, there's people who are very much aware of who their representatives are in different spaces. And that's just because of how, especially when it comes to the ZANU-PF side, how deeply involved they are in those systems out there, especially in the rural areas. So that's the thing. But you spoke about cult of personality, and I think that's a segue into the Robert Mugabe University.
Mm-hmm. I've forgotten about that.
The Robert Gabriel Mugabe University, which will be which is set to be constructed in Mazoe, where there is
cabinet has approved.
Yeah, cabinet has approved $800 million, and then there will be a $200 million endowment for research, I think. So the total comes to $8 billion, which is fascinating.
Fantastical. It's flabbergasting.
Where are they getting...
It's bamboozling.
Where is it? That was like my first question. I was like, where's the $1 billion coming from? Was that in our budget?
It's from the 15.
Anywhere.
It's from the 15.
So now we need 14 billion back. They're paying.
Yeah. No, Professor Moyo says that it's not like the money is coming all at once. But it still is incredible that, you know, it's the height of sycophancy. I've never seen someone kiss ass so successfully. As Jonathan Moyo, he's a master at fellatio.
Wow. Those are fighting words.
It's an incredible thing for someone who's the Minister of Higher and Tertiary Education, who's completely aware of how the university's NUST is not finished being built. Great Zimbabwe University hasn't been finished, but I mean, all of a sudden, this is something that they want to do. It makes me weak, actually.
My biggest issue with it is $1 billion, number one. And the person to spearhead this is Professor Jonathan Moyo, a man who is known
for stealing funds.
Known. This is, you know, and not known in Zimbabwe alone. In Kenya, yeah.
in South Africa.
You know, this is...
Yes, but
was
scandal
he indicted?
Was yeah.
You know...
Was he indicted? Did he go to court? I mean, you know...
Was he indicted?
Guys, I think he's a whole
minister. Zimbabwe was protected by Mugabe.
He's a whole minister. Okay. He's in Mugabe's hand. He's in the palm of Mugabe's hand.
You know what?
Hand.
I honestly.
I think he's in. Yeah, go ahead.
But it's very scary the way these things come up so haphazardly. You're speaking about NUST and GZU, but we have a lot of universities, and I think somebody else.
Polytechnics, too, that actually could use that money, which are also in the STEM. So I don't understand when they're like, oh, we're building a STEM university. NUST, what does National University of Science and Technology? Yeah. So there's also Chinoy University.
Yes.
Which is near Mazoe. Yeah.
There's Bindura as well.
You guys are missing the point. Yeah. None of those is called Robert Mugabe University.
But you can just change the name.
No,
it's a name change.
It's like getting secondhand clothes. Now he has a secondhand university. It's not the same.
These guys are going to effectively own
the whole of Mazoe.
Yeah, actually, yeah. That's another thing too.
I would not be surprised. If the land from where this university is being built, this is all conjecture at the moment, but I'm pretty sure if the land that is this university is being built, if it's not owned by the Mugabes at some point already, then they're going to acquire it and double dip in this thing.
Well, aren't there trustees in this university? The president and my Mugabe are, you know, the two trustees. I don't know if there'll be any more, but
maybe their kids.
But now
just pop some bottles up in there.
But all this goes through, and you know, I really wish I could see Minister Chinamasa's face when this came up in cabinet, because he knows that there's no money. He knows. And twice he's tried to say, I can't pay bonuses. Can we just scrap the thing because there's no money? And twice that was overturned. So I really wonder what the thinking is. Clearly, there is no logical thinking happening there. But, you know, how are people, how do they actually justify some of the things that they put out? Because there's no money.
How do they sleep at night?
I think it's like cognitive dissonance. You can recognize that our economy is where it is, but at the same time, you still want to pander. It's just
and then consider the fact that, you know, Prof said, I think it was Sir Nige, who asked him how many graduates there are, and he put out a figure of
24,000, I think.
Yeah, but no, it's over 30,000, including the polytechnics and the teachers' colleges as well. Mm-hmm. So every year, you're graduating over 30,000 people nationally.
To go where?
You see,
into which jobs?
Exactly. So take $1 billion and put it into something that creates
jobs.
Employment rather than building a university. They're actually going to tell you that building a university creates jobs because you need people to
teach.
To push wheelbarrows.
Oh, my God.
And
wash clothes is giving someone a job.
So between the university and the Bainbridge Road, they've created jobs, haven't they?
So, but you know, it's not sustainable because the university at some point will stop being built.
But don't we have too many universities for the size of population that we have? Are we producing enough high school graduates with adequate qualifications and ability? Because remember, we had a 10-year stint where there was no teaching happening. Who can then? Because you know, the graduates that I'm seeing, the ones on attachment, guys, it's scary, eh? They're people who can't write.
Yeah, I think that's also the thing, because we forget that with the way the economy has gone, you know, most people in Zim are living in the rural areas, and most people can't even afford to send their children to school anymore to finish. There are a lot of people, like a lot of domestic workers, like, for example, our former gardener, he's like 22. He's barely literate. He never finished grade 7. And for me, that was something that was like really shocking, because, you know, you're told, oh, Zim has such a high literacy rate. Yes. But then is that actually functional literacy? Just because someone can write their name and can count to 20, can we really say that person is functionally literate? So it's very top heavy to say, oh, we're building a university. Mm-hmm. Put that $1 billion into schools, primary schools. Their children, I think, is it in Matabeleland provinces, who have to go and walk for how many kilometers just to get to school? Because there are not enough schools in that district.
But even when there's a school, I went to Gokwe North, to Nembudzia. There's a school, I think it's Motimuri, that is literally Paul and Dhaka. And because they came from a flood, parts of the school are missing. So during the school day, when it rains, what's happening?
I know what Henry's doing on the side.
When it rains, they have to stand. Wanungana in a corner. And the teacher's in her corner with the blind. I mean, how do you learn in a condition like that? And this community is poor. Children are coming to school with no clothes, no food.
How can you concentrate if you haven't eaten?
It comes down to priorities. And you're right about primary schools as well. There was a primary school in Mutasa district that had its furniture
Taken away. Touched by the sheriff.
Exactly, yeah, because they had deaths. And literally all the tables, the classroom, everything, like kids were just standing now. So it comes down to priorities. Mm. And we've got our priorities completely wrong.
Messed up.
But it's become the culture, and it's a culture that needs to change. It needs to change when you have some sort of accountability and who these people are accountable to.
But they won't be, because even from a personal level, Jonathan Moyo's kids, they go to private school. Maybe they don't even learn in the country. They don't go to university in Zimbabwe. So for him, you know, he can make these decisions in a callous way because it doesn't affect him personally. But like you said, we have to change our culture, because someone who's in government should be for the people. It's not for personal gain. It's not to suck up to the center of power, whatever. You should be serving the people. Yeah.
Henry, you're going to say something?
I think at the end of the day, really, we can't expect them to do anything different from what they know and how they. It's just things to survive. People are doing these things to survive. The amount of impact that even if they were lying, saying we found $1 billion that we're going to put into the economy, you immediately would see an economic uptick on the like, you know, expectation of this. But I don't think we really have a situation where people are that concerned about it.
So yeah, we'll see what happens. And you know, carry on.
Interesting view is the view by Honorable Temba Moliso that he posted on Twitter just recently. That's what I was looking at just now, about the suggestion that this is some kind of golden parachute for Robert Mugabe as an exit package, you know, playing back on these insinuations and beliefs that Professor Jonathan is working for the Americans or has links to the Americans. I don't know if you guys put
Jonathan Moy even go things. To America.
Yeah,
like, yeah, he did.
I think he got his case. So he never got like sanctions for him to not travel. Or they've been lifted.
This was in the 80s or the 90s when he was there and he lectured there. But then there's always been
even the WikiLeaks documents.
Yeah, the WikiLeaks documents. There's things that he has links to the CIA, and that, you know, there's all sorts of conspiracy.
So why I think it's
innuendo.
It's not conspiracy because. No, why? I mean, it is conspiracy because there's proof in the WikiLeaks cables that Jonathan Moy has been speaking, or you at that point in time was speaking to the Americans a lot, and another person that was speaking to the Americans a lot is Temba Mliswe himself, particularly in Rungwe West, when he was literally running programs paid for by the Americans. So him saying it gives it a little bit more weight.
Okay, fair enough.
But I mean, it's obviously still a conspiracy, and one never knows these things.
Indeed, indeed. Speaking of,
On the subject of a golden parachute, I'd actually be okay with if it was going to get rid of the family forever. Just like a $10 million, here you go. We'll ask no questions. Just never come back.
You think?
I would be, as a taxpayer,
$10 million is nothing to you.
I'd be like, no, go. We'll ask you no questions. Take all your friends with you.
I was about to ask, you think $10 million is enough?
Hey, man, Bob is what, 94?
Mugabe travels with $3 million in his plane when he goes overseas.
But then we could end up this with, like,
this is something that the former finance minister told me. I know these things.
Yeah, we could end up with, like, a Sonny Abacha sort of situation. Mm. The former dictator of Nigeria, the military ruler, where, like, he literally stole billions of dollars from the Nigerian economy. But his family is there in Nigeria. They're living peacefully, man. So... You know,
nobody knocks on the door and says, give us
nothing. It was like a kleptomaniac.
But for Grace personally, for Grace personally. Yeah.
So, on Professor Moyo, a couple of days ago, was it yesterday? I'm not sure. A video from a presentation of his from Politburo.
The Blue Ocean Strategy.
Leaked. The Blue Ocean Strategy is actually not his. It's something they say that they're plotting, or anyway, yeah, it's the Mnangagwa faction's plot to usurp power from President Mugabe. So Professor Moyo presented this video in Politburo a couple of weeks ago. Apparently it's 72 minutes long. It's got, you know, different facets. There's all the statements guys like Matema Danda and Mutsangwa have been making. They are said to be aligned to his faction. There's journalists who were recorded speaking to Gandawa, I think. Gandawa is one of the Permsex who was caught up in this Zimdef scandal, if I'm not mistaken. But and so there's a whole bunch of stuff in there that Prof presented to Politburo to say that Mnangagwa has a faction and his sole purpose right now is to become the next president. And it leaked. I don't know how it leaked, or I suspect. But Prof,
who do you suspect?
It was Prof. No, honestly.
Because, unquote.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't make sense for it not to be him, because he's the one who made the thing. I don't see why, what use it would be for anyone in Mnangagwa's faction to, or him himself, to leak it, because it makes no sense. And, you know, Prof then tweeted that this is stolen property, you are not allowed to have it, or whatever. I responded, I said, well, report them to the police if it's stolen. So we'll see how that goes. I'll follow up with them. But
I didn't realize that Politburo meetings were recorded. Or is it just that special one?
No.
Was there like some sort of archive of all the meetings?
It's a presentation.
It was a presentation.
Okay.
So it was
he put together a presentation.
Yeah.
Like, first of all, can we talk about how much you have to dislike somebody to put together a 72-minute PowerPoint? That's, you know, that's levels of this. That's, ooh.
But you know what's funny is they actually went to Politburo and they missed question and answer, because Politburo always falls on a Wednesday when they're supposed to be in Parliament. Anyway, so they go to Politburo and they sit there for 72 minutes. That's like a feature. That's a movie. That's like watching a movie. And they all sat there and they watched this thing. To be fair, I'd watch it because I think...
Can I ask? Do you think Mugabe was awake during this whole thing?
No, he must have fallen asleep in the middle where the opening credits were right. Wow. If that...
Like, honestly, like, and but
he's probably like, whoa, what are you doing?
Those are not mine.
What are you doing?
So the boardroom is literally at the top of the Zanpia building, and they all sat around the boardroom table, and I really, you know,
do you think they watched it on a laptop?
If there is ever a film or something about the Zimbabwe situation, this is one of the moments that definitely needs to be in it, because it's incredible what they've done. But it goes to show how serious actually the factional wars within ZANU-PF have gotten. And there is the rumor, or the Independent reported that Vice President Mnangagwa tendered his resignation that was rejected by the president.
But if he did, you know how when when your girlfriend and boyfriend and you're fighting, and you want the upper hand, and then as the girlfriend, you're like, you know what, let's just break up, and it's a fake breakup. That's what he did. I feel like that's exactly what he did. He was just like, no, let's just break up because it's not working out for you. And
that means the relationship is not healthy, and they should break up anyway.
Well, obviously,
you know, I think if it is true, which I suspect it's not, but it's at that point where this has happened to Maya Mujuru before, and looking at the situation, you're basically saying, why am I here? What, you know, you, there's things happening. Maya Mugabe is openly in public reprimanding him. And I see, she said at in Chinoy, she said, the vice president and I used to be very good friends. I don't know if he still wants to be my friend. No, that's very open and clear.
Yeah.
She's attacking people who are said to be aligned to his faction publicly. So, and this is what happened to Maya Mujuru. So we're going to a situation where you're sort of replicating and you're looking at it and you're saying, well, you know what? I'm not going to play this game. So I'll go straight to the head and I will deal with it at the head. I don't believe he really wanted to resign if it was true. But it's basically saying, look, tell me what it is. Are we together in this thing where we're going? Or should I really just, you know...
But I think it was manipulative of both people in that situation. I think Mnangagwa was being manipulative in tendering his resignation after the 72-minute PowerPoint. And I think Mugabe is never one to let anyone, you know, just get away scot-free. He's like, you made your bed. Lie in it. I'm not sure what to make of any of this. I really, because I feel we may be saying this and then come next year they'll all be like united on the the ballot. So,
oh no, come next year they're going in as a unit. That's definitely what's happening.
As a unit, yeah.
That's definitely what's happening. It's just
it's just now these finding each other.
Yeah, but also who gets what? What's happening? And I really do think that within the Mugabe family, and you know, there really are preparations for what happens post Mugabe's presidency, whether it is due to death, whether it is due to him stepping down, whatever the case might be, there really is a lot of concern over what happens within the family, what happens to the political party as ZANU-PF, because he really is the thread that is holding
everything together.
And everyone.
But isn't that what Solomon Mujuru had been warning for years? To say that, you know, he should pick a... I'm saying, wasn't that Solomon Mujuru's, like, main concern when he was still alive to say, pick a successor and then...
Yeah.
I don't know. Just sort of maybe did that die with him?
The only person that Grace can trust to protect the Mugabe interests financially and her interests is herself.
So but why angle for Korean politics, though? Because I feel like if your husband's been president/dictator for 37 years, you're building a holiday home in the south of France. You kind of don't want to be asked anything after that.
They can't go to the south of France. Sanctions.
I think, and also the thing is maybe, I think we're giving these people too much credit. Yeah, I think we're giving them too much credit because a lot of the times I think they have this mentality to say that, oh, I'm always going to be in the system, so I don't need to sort of like, you know, externalize my money. We've seen it happen with a lot of former politicians who are now like broke and having their asset seized and stuff like that. So maybe they didn't have a contingency plan.
Well, that's poor planning, especially for a woman who's the mother of three children who are completely dependent on the state.
I think it's not about money.
You don't think it's about
not
money?
It's not about money at all. They've got plenty of money, and if they were to be out of power and leave the country, they will be okay.
But then why does she want to be vice president?
It's really about power. I don't know. It's about power.
And why does she want power? Because without her husband, does she still have power? That's my question. If he's gone, does she still, will she still be powerful?
If she's president, she does then. If she's president, she'll be a one-term president.
She'll be a one-term. Because it's like, she attacked Maimjuru in favor of, who gained from that? Mnangagwa, right? She's now attacking Mnangagwa, I'm assuming, in favor of herself. But the thing, her power comes from her husband's position and existence. Once he's gone, once he's out, where is she?
That's why she's working so hard to build her own base now.
But does she, yeah, is she a credible?
That's why
she does not have a base.
Is she credible? Because she herself, I'm afraid, yeah, if I support her, it could be, we could be together today and Mangwana, she's going to be saying my name at her rally. I don't need those problems.
That whole thing, Mnuwesi Kunamai, all those people, that whole thing is her building her own political base and her own political mileage. Her attacking these people, all these things, her power is derivative at the moment, but she's slowly gaining her own base. And her husband tempers some of her, you know, baser instincts, in my opinion. But at the end of the day, when push comes to shove, you might find people like Xavier, people like Jonathan, supporting a presidential bid or a vice presidential bid from Grace, because it ensures their interests. And if she's in the presidium, she's in the presidium, and I think they'll respect that. And this is all conjecture and hyperbole at the moment, yeah, but that's genuinely where I see it going.
We'll definitely have to see how it plays out. It's always interesting. She's not at the rally, as I said earlier, today in Gwanda. So no fireworks there. It will be, you know, run-of-the-mill.
Boring.
Depends on who you ask. Huh? Yeah. Depends on, no, but definitely, I mean, it's very exciting. At least the papers have something to report. So I generally expect it to be very, very basic. They probably have started right now. They're likely to be opening another, what do they call them? Community information centers.
Oh my God. Is that like
an internet cafe?
Yeah.
It's a community information center.
So a PC from 1980 something before the internet.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Floppy. Like my floppy
disk. All right.
Yeah, no.
Thank you so much, Tonde, and thank you, Openyu. Well, in case you guys haven't noticed, is here to stay.
I thank Andy and Dave for this.
Yes. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah.
I don't know if you...
Pleasure to be
Tunde,
here.
You can tell us... You didn't actually plug your blog. You didn't tell us where we can find you on online property.
Thank you. You can find me at The Young African on all my platforms, Twitter, WordPress, Facebook, Instagram. So follow me there.
All right, cool. Openyu?
I'm on Twitter at Openyu Makoni. I'm everywhere at Openyu Makoni.
So there's something I always forget to mention whenever Openyu is here.
Yeah.
That Openyu is...
I'm suing the government.
Yes.
Really? Yeah, I'm suing the government.
Yes,
well, me and like, I don't know how many other people have now signed up to sue the government for the right to vote. So it's the right to vote action, yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, she's the lead applicant in a class action against the government, against ZEC, and I don't know how many other respondents are on that. But the right to vote, none of this registering business.
I don't agree with it. I think you should just present your proof, your ID, or your passport, or your whatever it is that shows you're a citizen of this country, and vote, right? Yeah,
that's fair.
Yeah.
So, do you know when it's going into the...
We submitted the paperwork. Well, the very nice lawyer submitted the paperwork. I had nothing to do with that. And I think we're just waiting for a date. So yeah, I'll feedback next time.
Was this an application to the Constitutional Court?
It's an application to the High Court.
High Court, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It hasn't gone to the Crown Court yet, but we're hoping.
Okay.
And Tenability Law is the one to... I'm correct, right?
Oh yeah, Tunde is It's I think we are. So Tunde, maybe you should just check Kandaka CV. I know.
Yeah, I know. One word check about bus. Anyway, you can find me at Chris Charamba on all social media. Yeah, hit me up.
And yeah, I'm Henry Rebiti on all social media.
You can't say Henure.
Because Henry, then it will be spelt badly. Weren't you there when we were talking about literacy?
H-E-N-R-Y, Henure.
Wow, okay. Anyway, thank you very much. You listening to Politics and Beyond on Capital 263.
Free to say?
Free to do it.
That's a penis line.
Yeah, I should say that part.
Oh, yeah. And now. Capital 263.